Bill Littlefield is a graduate of Yale and Harvard. He joined Curry College in 1976 as a professor of humanities. In the early to mid-80s, he taught sports writing at the Harvard University Summer School. And in 1984, he became a regular sports commentator on Morning Edition. After starting up only a game, he returned as a weekly Morning Edition commentator here on AM 580 in 1996. He's authored books including Baseball Days, Champions, The Stories of 10 Remarkable Athletes, The Novel Prospect, and most recently, Keepers, Radio Stories from Only a Game and Elsewhere. Bill Littlefield joins us now from the studios of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Hi again, Bill.
Hi, Craig. How you doing?
I'm well. Welcome back.
Good. Thank you.
For those listeners who are not regular fans of Only a Game, who maybe haven't listened to the show, maybe you could just start off by once again explaining what Only a Game is all about.
Well, I think Only a Game is perhaps best explained as the public radio take on sports, and that simply means that we're less concerned with, playing 110%, taking it one game at a time, and all of those kinds of cliches, and maybe even less concerned with the wins and losses and more concerned with good stories. And we try and find them in all the different sports each week and present them as well as we can.
And how do you determine which sports to cover?
Well, we have, of course, in this country, a wide variety to choose from. We get a lot of suggestions from listeners. One of my favorite recent stories was the story of the Bates College water skiing team, which is up in Maine. And we got a letter from a listener saying, "My son is on the Bates College water skiing team, and you should cover it because sometimes they go out on the lake while there's still ice on it." And that was irresistible. So we immediately dispatched our star reporter to Lewiston, Maine to do that story.
Oh, man. I'm just getting the image of water skiing.
Oh, it's great.
Pockets of ice.
It was the only group of athletes that I've ever heard about, Craig, who said that they didn't mind competing. They kind of tolerated the competition so that they could have the fun of going out and practicing. And most athletes, of course, it's just the opposite. They endure practice so that they can get the adrenaline rush of competing against another athlete or another team. But these folks, you know, they just like to water ski, and the way it was set up, they had to be on the team to water ski, and so they were on the team.
I want to talk a lot about Only a Game this hour, but I also want to give callers an opportunity to talk with us once again. If you'd like to talk with Bill Littlefield, call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. And we do have a caller on line number 4 calling from Aurora. Let's get that caller on the air. Hi, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Yeah, hi. Hi again. Nice to hear you back.
Thank you.
And, of course, baseball is ending, and I'm so sorry that it is. That's the only thing I like about summer. My daughter recently sent me an article from the Daily Herald, and the article was, "Should We Forgive Shoeless Joe?"
Ah.
And I believe yes, even before I read the article. I don't think he did that. I know what he did wasn't possibly correct, but even when somebody goes to prison, he comes out and possibly rehabbed.
Right.
And we forgive them. Why don't we forgive people like Pete Rose either if they're rehabbed, if they've been away from the love of their life, and baseball is the absolute love of their life? Why don't we forgive them?
It's an interesting question. Of course, the Pete Rose situation and the Joe Jackson situation are very different from each other in a number of ways. One is that Joe Jackson is dead, and it's much easier to forgive Joe Jackson than it is to forgive Pete Rose, who's still out there selling baseball bats and autographed balls and shirts and gloves and everything else he can get his hands on and demonstrating that he's still pretty much 100% hustler, and so it's a little bit hard for baseball to forgive him.
Yeah, but aren't half of the people in baseball hustlers?
Yes, of course, but half the people in baseball...
They're building all these new stadiums.
Right.
You know, I just...
You're absolutely right. I think the problem with Pete Rose, probably he won't be accepted back into the fold right away by the current commissioner simply because his predecessor as commissioner, Bart Giamatti, found that Rose gambled on baseball and on his own team, and that was, at least according to Giamatti's standards, the ultimate sin against the game. Joe Jackson took money to perform badly in the World Series and then apparently decided that he was constitutionally incapable of performing badly. He performed brilliantly. And interestingly enough, a jury found him innocent. All of the White Sox who were guilty of the Black Sox scandal were found innocent in court, or not guilty, I should say. And, of course, the commissioner at that time, Commissioner Landis, said, I don't care what the court said, they'll never play baseball again, and I'm banning them from the game. The other thing that's interesting to me about the Jackson story is the extremes that it still inspires. A recent biography of Jack Dempsey by Roger Kahn. Roger Kahn refers to the people who want Joe Jackson to be forgiven and to be accepted into the Baseball Hall of Fame as fanatics, as crazies. And I don't know if he's aware of the fact that one of those crazy fanatics is Ted Williams, who has been working very hard to get baseball to accept Joe Jackson back into the fold. So people feel passionate about that issue on both sides, even though that World Series was way back in 1919.
Why, when we forgave the president for what all he did, whatever that was all about, and Nixon for whatever he did, and why is baseball so different?
Well, baseball is even more straight-laced than the Republican Party, vis-a-vis Nixon. I mean, and Ford forgave Nixon. Who else did? I'm not sure how many other people have actually forgiven him or Mr. Clinton.
The Chinese did.
Yes, absolutely. That's true. They paid him a lot of money to come visit, didn't they?
But does that count? I think these men provide us with so much and give so much, and of course they get these days in monies, but I don't know that baseball, you know, and I think it is and should be kept as strict and as clean as possible, but then is it truly in fact kept that clean and straight?
Well, baseball has a huge stake in making you believe that it is, and that's why baseball came down so hard on Pete Rose, because if once people start to think that the players are betting on their teams or even against their teams, then the whole illusion kind of collapses. But, yeah, I'm sure that what Pete Rose did is not at all unique or unusual even. He had the misfortune to be caught, and then he's a very stubborn kind of coarse guy, and he made an easy target, and he hasn't exactly made it easy for people to
forgive him, huh?
Forgive him, exactly.
Well, I'll give somebody else a chance, and thank you much for baseball.
I'm on your side, by the way, as far as Joe Jackson is concerned. I hope both of them get into the Hall of Fame sometime soon. It is, after all, the Hall of Fame, not the Hall of Morality or, you know, good fellowship.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. And you can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Bill, I think there's also one other difference between Joe Jackson and Pete Rose, and that is that after the Black Sox scandal and every year thereafter, it was posted, as I understand it, in every Major League ballpark, in the dressing rooms, in the training rooms, a very clear indication: you are not to bet on baseball. That is the one cardinal rule of Major League Baseball, and they really went out of their way to say so.
It still is posted, but, you know, Joe Jackson and his teammates knew that what they were doing was wrong. There's no question about that, even though the signs hadn't gone up in the clubhouses yet.
Right.
So, yeah, of course, it's and Rose was, as a longtime player and occupant of a dugout and clubhouse, he was well aware that what he was doing also was likely to get him into trouble.
Let's move on to another caller, line number one, caller from Bloomington. Hi, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon. This is not about politics, so this is about your book, Prospect.
Oh, wonderful.
I'd like to know if any of the characters in there were based on real people.
Some of the characters were based on real people to some extent. I have a friend who's a baseball scout, an older man, not as old as Pete Esty, and he's a great storyteller, and some of the stories came from old baseball guys that I have known. And some of the characteristics of some of the people in the nursing home in which a fair chunk of the novel takes place, are characteristics that people I knew had. Both of my grandmothers spent long periods of time in a nursing home, and I visited both of them on occasion and remembered a lot of things about those places when I was writing the novel. But I wouldn't say that anybody none of the characters in the novel are created from real-life people precisely.
Uh-huh. Is Louise Brown, is she based on anything at all, or is she purely fictional?
Louise Brown is based on a number of people that I have known, and uh-huh. But she is more saintly than any of them. I wish I knew somebody like Louise, because if I did, I would follow her example everywhere.
Well, thanks very much, sir.
Thank you. I really appreciate your mentioning the book. It's like many books, long out of print, and it's nice that people are still aware of it.
Since we started on the subject of baseball, let's stick to that. I remember asking you this the last time you were on, but quite honestly, I don't remember how you responded, so I'll ask again.
It'll probably be different this time anyway, so not to worry.
Is the ball juiced?
I was talking to a writer, Joe Falls, a long, long-time baseball writer in Detroit, and Joe Falls has no doubt about it at all. He refers to the baseball currently in use as that goddamn golf ball.
Oh, my.
He's convinced that it is completely juiced, and that's why it's flying out of various ballparks at such unprecedented rates. We, of course, have two guys over 60 with a week to go still.
That's right.
This year once again. The pitchers will certainly tell you that it is, and Joe Falls watches every game in Tiger Stadium, and he says it is, so it wouldn't surprise me if somebody at MIT were to cut open a baseball in use this year and one from 25 years ago or whenever and find that there's a substantial difference.
I think that to give some credit to Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire, who are two of the we cover the Cubs and Cards here on this station.
Sure.
And obviously in Champaign-Urbana, we're pretty much right in between St. Louis and Chicago, and so there's a lot of a following of both of those players. I don't think that the fact that they hit 60 home runs is so much of an indication that the ball's juiced, as is the fact that, say, someone like Edgar Renteria is approaching 10. That's the part that always – because,
right.
You know, Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa can both hit the ball out of the ballpark, and I don't think it matters what kind of ball they use.
Right.
You know, they could use a hockey puck, and they would still be able to fire it over the wall.
Yeah, you still have to worry a little bit, though, when you know, the totals are increasing by such a factor as they have been lately. But that's a good point. I remember the year here in Boston when Wade Boggs suddenly hit 20 more home runs than he'd ever hit, and everybody sort of scratched their heads and said, what's going on here?
I think Jose Oquendo could have a dozen this year if he wanted.
Yeah, it is a strange phenomenon.
Let's take some more calls. We'll go to line number one, caller from Champaign. Hi, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. Sorry to change the subject. I missed a number of episodes, and I was really intrigued with the of Only a Game.
Yeah.
I was really intrigued with the basketball, the minor league, or I don't know what the right term is. I think there was a guy who was a prospect. He was going to be a center for the Pacers, maybe.
Right.
And whatever happened with him? I was really curious about that story. By the way, that whole batch of stories I think that you do about the people that don't quite make it are some of the most compelling stuff that you do. Anyway, I want to hang up and listen. And thanks a lot. Great show.
Thank you. The Pacers did not end up requiring the services of the player that your caller has just asked about. This was a kid who was pretty high on Larry Bird's list at one point, but is still a minor league player, and we'll see what happens to him in the future. He's still a pretty young guy.
Let's go on to line number two, caller from Urbana. Hi.
All right. Have you seen the movie, For the Love of the Game?
I haven't seen the movie. The company that put the movie out recently sent me a paperback copy of the book upon which the movie is based, and I read the book. And I don't know even how closely the movie follows the book, but I haven't seen the film yet. Have you seen it?
Yeah, the baseball in it, I think, is the best that I've ever seen on film.
Uh-huh.
But there's one part in it that when you do see it, you should be looking for. There's a flashback when an outfielder runs back and the ball hits him on the head and, you know, bounces over an 8-foot fence, Canseco style. But trouble is, we're told that this happened at Fenway Park, and there aren't any 8-foot fences at Fenway.
You got that right.
You know, it's 4 feet over and right and 30-some-odd feet over and left and about, what, 15, 20 feet in center?
Depends on what part of center. But, yes, you're right. There is no 8-foot fence.
So it couldn't happen at Fenway.
Nope. No, even a head as hard as Jose Canseco's wouldn't bounce one over the Green Monster and left.
Well, tell me about the Save Fenway movement in Boston. And are they going to tear it down? Are they going to move it, or are they going to restore it?
I would think that if I were a betting man, my money would be on building a new ballpark adjacent to the old ballpark, and they're going to, I think, retain a portion of the old ballpark as a kind of shrine and museum. There is a plan. A group called Save Fenway Park that you referred to put forward a plan for renovating the stadium. And they maintained that it would be much less expensive and also much less disruptive for people living in that area of the city and require much less infrastructure and less monkeying around with the roads that are presently there. There was an article just today in the paper on the front page of the Globe that maintained that an independent agency examining that plan had said that the Save Fenway Park plan would in fact cost almost as much, if not as much, as building a new ballpark. The Red Sox very much want to build a new ballpark for the reasons that all teams crave new ballparks, at least all teams that don't already have brand new ballparks, and that is that in a new park they could surround it with luxury boxes and tremendously increase their income. They maintain that they would also have more less expensive seats so that both classes of fans would be well served. And you would expect them to say nothing different on the eve of trying to get the city and the state behind the construction of a new ballpark.
Well, if you had your druthers, what would you like to see them do?
I think if I had my druthers, I'd like to see them build a new ballpark. The old Fenway is a wonderful place. It's a great place to see a ball game. But if you're over about 5'7", you're going to leave with an aching back and sore knees. And numbers of seats in the current Fenway, which has undergone a few expansions over the years, numbers of seats don't even face the field very well, so that you kind of sit turned sideways to watch the game, and so you have not only sore back and cranky knees, but a stiff neck as well. It's an old place, and I think it's been a wonderful place to see baseball for a long, long time, but it probably does make sense to replace it at this point.
Do you think that the new one could approximate the charm of Fenway?
Well, that's what they're after, and in fact, it's the way the blueprints and the renderings that they've shown me and shown everybody here in Boston indicate that they not only want to approximate the charm, they want to recreate it. They've got a left field wall in the new park. They've got all kinds of sort of nooks and crannies built into the new park, which are very much like the dimensions of the old one. And, of course, they also want to do what the Orioles did in Camden Yards and the Indians did in Jacobs Field. They want to, graft on all the amenities that people enjoy now, restrooms that are functional, for example, as opposed to the ones in Fenway Park right now.
Well, of course, it does cry out for a decent scoreboard.
Well, that's the interesting thing. In the new park, they're going to have a manual scoreboard, too. They'll have the new one. They'll have the Jumbotron and, you know, with all of the bells and whistles that people have come to expect. But they're going to have a manual scoreboard in there as well, like the old one in left field.
I just hope in the new one they have the little lights that indicate balls and strikes.
Oh, yeah. Got to have that.
Instead of having electronic numerals, have 1, 2, and 3 lights light up.
That'd be great. And still have Tom Yawkey's initials and Morse code somewhere on the scoreboard, the way they do at Fenway Park. You know, all that crazy idiosyncratic stuff. And, I used to feel like tearing down Fenway Park would be an abomination, but that was before they built the most recent generation of new baseball fields. And those places are great. They're fun. There's too much of the mall feel to some of them, and there's too much of the idea that you go shopping and go to the food court and, oh, by the way, there's a baseball game that you might take in if you get tired of shopping or eating. But still, they're very nice ballparks to go into. They're much better than the ones they were building back in the 70s and early 80s. And I think probably, like all buildings, Fenway Park has a lifespan, and we're probably pretty close to the end of it.
Well, enjoy talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. There are three ballparks, Bill, that are closing this year. Candlestick, Tiger
yep.
Stadium, and one that I don't think people are going to be too sad about seeing disappear, and that's the Astrodome.
Yeah, the Astrodome was called the Great Horror of the World by about the same number of people who called it the Seventh Wonder of the World, I guess. No, I don't think people will be too sorry to see that go. And Tiger Stadium, of course, went through a similar situation to the one that your caller was just referring to. They had a big group of people who were involved in an organization called Save Tiger Stadium. And they went and gave Tiger Stadium a big group hug, and they tried with architectural plans to prove that it could be renovated in order to serve everybody's needs and interests at least as well as a new ballpark could. And it just didn't work out. I think that the people who really have the decision-making power simply decided they wanted a new park, and that was that.
Well, I chained myself to the St. Louis Arena front gate, and they still bulldozed, so what are you going to do?
Well, I hope you got out of the way in time. You didn't lose your feet or something.
Just barely, yeah. Let's go on to line number three, caller from Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi, guys. I'm kind of late in on the action here. I've got a question about the Ryder Cup, if you haven't covered that already.
Yes, we haven't talked about that yet.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm just wondering if you thought that the American celebration was in good taste, if we can be excused for our jubilation, in particular what surrounded the putt that Justin Leonard sank to clinch, or if the Europeans may have a point in kind of criticizing the way we all carried on the other day when that thing wound up. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Bill, that's really developed into a very fairly jingoistic tournament, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Well, actually, it had been something that numbers of people took very, very seriously for the last couple of Ryder Cups. I think that you have to separate two things here. The celebration that the American players and their wives and people directly connected with the Ryder Cup staged when Justin Leonard sunk his putt seemed to me to be a spontaneous outburst of just, incredible enthusiasm and joy that they'd managed to come back from the deficit that they created for themselves on Friday.
And it was a 45-foot putt, after all.
Totally unlikely to have something happen that way.
Yeah.
So I think you have to cut them a little bit of slack. And actually, I was sort of encouraged because golfers are such button-downed, uptight people so often that it was kind of nice to see him cut loose and celebrate. I think the other part of it, though, is the really kind of intolerable behavior of some of the fans at that tournament. And within the context of golf, you don't hear a lot of golf fans shouting insults at golfers at the top of their backswing the way some of the U.S. fans were doing to some of the European players. And that was very unfortunate. And I thought, obviously within the context of baseball or football, it's nothing. People scream out all kinds of things at ball players when they're hitting or trying to make a play in the field. But in golf, there is a certain etiquette that people have respected in the past and that they obviously did not respect on some occasions at the Ryder Cup.
I once suggested some changes to golf, for example, full contact
golf. Yeah, full contact golf.
You put these people on thin blades and you got something, then somebody reminded me I'm a hockey fan, and that's why
absolutely.
I thought that.
Yeah. Well, they dig up those nice courses, though, if you had people kind of falling face first into them and stuff like that.
Lots of divots. And you had just pointed out the idea of sort of a spontaneous reaction among the players on the American squad. I think you could almost tie that to one of the European players who's just sort of burst onto the tour, who's sort of creating that that excitement in the sport, and that's Sergio Garcia.
Yeah, once more proving that a high school diploma is not a necessary component of success. He's just got his driver's license, somebody told me. He got a postcard during the Ryder Cup saying, "Congratulations, you passed the driver's test." He's a great story, and it's kind of too bad that that so much of the conversation about the Ryder Cup now is about whether the fans misbehaved or whether the players celebrated too early and too loudly and too indiscreetly. Because what the story really should be about is some exceptional golf that was played over the course of 3 days. And, it was like all sports events. It was full of remarkable performances, and especially on Sunday, collectively, probably the most remarkable performance by a group of golfers that anybody's ever witnessed.
How much of that discussion, though, was sort of predestined by the U.S. players asking to be paid?
Well, partly by their asking to be paid, and partly by the kind of I don't know what the right adjective is for the maybe your listeners would come up with better adjectives for characterizing some of the members of the U.S. team. And they're not team guys.
Yeah.
You know, golf is not a team sport. This is a kind of weird format under which to assemble these guys. So maybe they don't quite know how to talk about, selflessness and team play.
We're talking with commentator Bill Littlefield. He's the host of Only a Game, which you can hear Saturdays at noon on AM 580, and he has his commentaries Friday mornings on Morning Edition. Let's go on now to a caller on line number 4 from Charleston. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I have a couple of factual questions. I've got somebody running a machine right next to me. I'm at a pay phone, so that's why it sounds so terrible. But I've been trying to find out where the idea of the seventh inning stretch comes from.
Uh-oh.
What year that developed, and why. Somebody said it was Calvin Coolidge. He was so heavy or something in the early 20s. And had to stand up because he was heavy. I don't know. I can't find the factual verification of that.
I don't think Calvin Coolidge was all
he
that
was
heavy,
was he?
He was a normal sized guy.
Well, that's
what
somebody told me.
Yeah, well, okay, we can throw that one out. What's candidate number 2?
I don't know. That's the only person I've ever had that told me anything at all about that. I don't know. I have no idea.
I don't know. It's somewhere in the sort of foggy, misty regions of my mind. It has to do with, I think, somebody coming into the stadium that everybody stood up for, and it became some sort of tradition. But that may be completely a figment of my imagination. I don't know. I don't know where the seventh inning stretch came from. I know that Harry Carey in Chicago made it the phenomenon that it has become with his singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game."
Yeah, and that's my second question, actually. Why with "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" they don't celebrate the feminine with the actual song that was written in 1908 or whatever it was? You know, Katie Casey was baseball mad.
Right.
She had the fever and had it bad and all that stuff.
Right.
Why those verses aren't included?
Because then it would be dark by the time they got to the eighth inning.
Yeah.
I know that song because I had the opportunity to write the liner notes for a wonderful CD that came out several years ago of old baseball music. And a new rendition of the original song was on that CD. And you're right, it has a marvelous chorus, "Take Me Out to the Ball Game," but an even more marvelous collection of verses. And it's a story of a woman who is saying to her boyfriend, her beau, "Take me out to the ball game," and it's great.
It seems an early feminist song.
Yes, exactly. She's trying to convince him that she's as interested in the game as anybody else, and it's great.
And the third question I have, and this is an opinion, rather than fact. But I love the Ken Burns movie about baseball,
mm-hmm.
but I have intellectual friends that say they don't like it for one reason or another, and I wondered what your opinion was of the Ken Burns movie.
I thought portions of it were absolutely wonderful, and my way of watching it was kind of to pick the eras of baseball in which I was most interested, but I thought 18 hours devoted to baseball was rather... No, I mean, I watched it the way my public television station presented it,
oh.
but boy, I thought 18 hours was an awful lot.
Yeah.
I enjoyed portions of it, and every single minute that had Willie Mays and the Giants of the 50s on the film, I certainly watched all of that, and there were portions of it that I could kind of pass on.
Okay. And my final question is, what relation do you see between literature, for example, Shakespeare, and baseball?
I don't see too much relation between Shakespeare and baseball. Certainly it's true that an awful lot of the good baseball, a lot of the good sports novels and a lot of the good sports writing has come in response to baseball. But it's not all baseball. There's a lot of great boxing writing that I've read recently, and John Updike has written wonderful stuff on golf, among other things.
Yeah.
So, you know, baseball is certainly one of the sources of some great writing that is based in sports. People do say that a lot of literary people are Red Sox fans, and I think that may be because of some kind of dark connection that probably we don't have time or the inclination to explore, but beyond that, I don't know.
Well, thank you very much for your answers.
Thank
You're
you.
You're one of the great announcers on public radio. I
Thanks.
Appreciate your work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And if you would like to join in the conversation, call 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Let's go on to line number two, caller from Danville.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
I just have a comment to make, and the comment that I wanted to make, I've been wanting to make this comment to you for a long time, because I listen to this program every week. And it's not by choice that I listen to it. I'm a captive audience, and the other people have to listen to this program. And it's not that this is a bad program or anything like that. It's just that this is a very narrow program for the type of people that participate in analyzing or talking about this game or these games. That I noticed that is kind of a sad situation, because what I have to do is put an asterisk by everybody's name who appears there, because there is only a narrow group of people who appear there, and it's kind of unfortunate, because I do like Charlie Pierce.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he's a fantastic and a funny individual. He makes me laugh every Saturday, I'll tell you that. However, I do notice that there is a very narrow group of people that they talk about these sports, and I did not want to, that was not a question or anything else, it was just something that I wanted you to think about, that as you produce or prepare these programs, that everybody has not been allowed to participate in these programs. Thank you.
Okay. Well, certainly it's not a question of allowing. We have quite a large number of freelance writers as well as a very small staff here in Boston. And, you know, without the caller being more specific, I don't know how else to respond to that. But there's no quota system, and it's not a question of who we allow to contribute. It's who brings in story ideas and what we're able to do with them.
And I guess you don't generally limit yourself in the kinds of stories that you would do.
No, quite the contrary. As I say, a lot of the story ideas that come in from listeners. And if we can find, you know, people, we have a number of people in different places who write for us on a more or less regular basis, people from Louisiana to California to Chicago to Texas, all over Oregon. But it's not a question of saying we only want a narrow range of storytellers.
Let's take another call. Line number one, caller from Champaign. Hi, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Hello. I would like to speak to the guest about, I have an undying admiration for Babe Ruth. However, I was born in 1961, and Henry Aaron hitting 715 was the second biggest thing in my life to the Apollo moon landing. And I have heard on public television that Henry Aaron was scared to hit 715, and when he did, he was booed by the audience out of racism. And I would like to hear some positive stuff about Hank Aaron. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for the call.
I never heard that Henry Aaron was scared. Quite the contrary. Aaron was threatened. There were certainly idiots out there who wrote letters, of course, neglecting to sign them, who said, if you break Babe Ruth's record, you'll never leave the stadium alive. And they were vile, nasty, insulting threats that came into Aaron at the time that he was on the brink of breaking that record. I never heard that he was scared, and certainly it didn't intimidate him from hitting not only his 715th and 716th, but lots more home runs as well. I have nothing but good things to say about Hank Aaron. He was not only a fantastic ball player, but an extraordinary study in consistency and perseverance and in carrying a team often that probably didn't deserve anybody as good as him. So I had nothing but very positive memories of Aaron myself, somebody that I watched play throughout a lot of my growing up years and then on into my adulthood.
We have lines open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And about 4 or 5 minutes left, we might be able to sneak in another call or two. If you call right now, 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Well, we talked so much about baseball, I didn't leave a lot of time to talk about some other sports. I know one that has been pretty close to you, to your heart. We talked about, before the World Cup, we talked about the women's soccer team.
Right.
I guess that was that last spring, last winter. What do you think should, because it really, the sport continues to rise in stature after that win. What should be the next step to ensure the sport continues to grow and have success?
Well, I'm not sure what the next step should be. I think that in a fairly short time, you're going to see interest cranking up for the Olympics, which will be the next big test for the women's national team in this country. And they'll face some of the same teams in the Olympics that they had very close matches with in the Women's World Cup. The sport continues to grow, and in the town where I live, it's hugely popular for boys and girls right up through high school age. And I hope that it will continue to grow. And I think that the women on the national team have comported themselves with such extraordinary goodwill, and they've been so incredibly giving to their fans. I mean, these are players who will not only play as hard as they can every time they have the opportunity, but who stand around and sign autographs and talk to the kids for as long as the kids can stand it. They are great folks as well as extraordinary athletes, and I think they deserve every bit of attention that they've gotten since winning the World Cup.
You mentioned the Olympics, and I almost hesitate to bring it up because it's been kind of a negative the last few months, but considering the Salt Lake scandal and the recent allegations about the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, do you think maybe it's time to in some way revamp either the site selection process or maybe the Olympics as a whole?
Well, I think probably it's been time to revamp the International Olympic Committee for a long, long time. I mean, it's a collection of extremely powerful and extremely self-important people who probably, have been doing. We've probably only seen a very small amount of the abuse that's actually been going on in the site selection and a lot of the other stuff having to do with the Olympics. But I think the challenge for somebody watching the games is to separate all of the foolishness, in some case criminal foolishness, from the delight that we can still take in a great sports performance. And that's what I was referring to in saying how much I was looking forward to seeing the Olympics, and more specifically the U.S. women's soccer team playing again in that context where they'll be playing against the best teams in the world rather than in the friendly matches, which are all we have between the big tournaments.
The National Hockey League season starts in about a week or so.
Oh, my God.
I know.
It's time for that?
It is time. they are changing. One of the changes this year is the overtime format. They're now going to go four skaters aside to try and make it a more exciting finish and avoid some ties. Do you think a change like that might bring fans into the sport or make it in any way more exciting?
20% fewer injuries.
That's true.
Fewer guys on the ice.
That's right.
I don't know. Hockey has kind of been the sort of sick second cousin of the major sports for an awfully long time. I don't know. I don't really have any idea whether more people will get involved because of a rule change like that, or whether, hockey will just have to continue to be popular in certain regions and less popular in others.
And yet they continue to expand southward
southward and westward. It's the Sun Belt sport, no question about it. It's very weird, but, the American sports landscape is full of weird things. We're talking about the Ryder Cup before. Can you imagine how funny it must seem to a hockey fan that people are upset about the way the players and the fans at the Ryder Cup behave themselves?
Oh, well, I am a hockey fan, and I do feel that way.
Wait a minute. There's no blood on the green. There's nobody with a stick sticking out from between his shoulder blades. How bad can it have been?
Well, and as an example, the Blackhawks were involved in a pretty big scrum with the Capitals a few days ago. The Capitals' general manager apparently took a swing at the Hawks' coach, gave him a black eye, and this is preseason.
Sure, it's hockey.
And maybe that's the problem. The league continues to try to be competitive on the level of the other major sports, but as long as incidents like that are occurring, do you think they'll ever be anything other than second class?
I don't know. There used to be an old joke here in Boston, when the Boston Garden, I don't know, what did it seat? However many thousand people it seated, and they used to say it was exactly the same people who went to every game. They filled the building every night with exactly the same people every time.
When the Blues were supposed to move to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, back in the early mid-80s from St. Louis, the comment was, well, there are only 10,000 people in Saskatoon, but they'll all be there.
They'll all be there every night, exactly. Right. Exactly, no problem. Attendance will be just fine.
Bill, unfortunately, we are out of time. Had a great time talking with you once again. I hope we can do this again in the future.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure, Craig.
That's Bill Littlefield, the host of Only a Game, heard Saturdays at noon on AM 580. Don't forget you can check out the Only a Game website at www.onlyagame.org. We want to thank Bill Littlefield and WBUR in Boston for getting him in the studio today.